Okay, starting in, we would be starting in chapter 19, but we need to back up just a little bit into chapter 18, a couple of very specific verses. Verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. Just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God or see this great fire anymore, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, they are right in what they have spoken. Somebody read verse 18.
I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him.
Okay. And whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Is that singular and or plural? Prophet. So the Jews took that verse, specifically verse 18, and they ran with it. And what does that mean? There was to be a prophet that came along, a singular prophet, a prophet like Moses, but we would say greater than Moses. And the references to the prophet keep on coming up in the New Testament. So we're going to do a little chase through of those verses. Be quick getting there. John chapter 1 is the first. And this is when Philip goes to Nathanael, and it starts in 43. Philip was from Bethsaida. Verse 45, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, somebody want to read that?
We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.
Yeah. And that is who Moses, well, the verse that Moses wrote about is Deuteronomy 18:18. There's more. Acts chapter 7. That would be Stephen called to account. Verse 37.
What was the chapter, Pastor?
Acts chapter 7. It's when Stephen is before the council and they will kill him. 35, Moses, whom they rejected. Verse 36, this man led them out. Verse 37, then.
This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear.
Mm-hmm. And anyone who will not, the Lord will require it of him. Also in Acts, back in chapter 3, this would be Peter. Acts And this is after the lame beggar is healed, and they're in the temple courts, and the people are running to them. And Peter says in verse 17, "Now, brothers, I know that you acted in ignorance in denying Jesus." Verse 19, "Repent, therefore." 20, "The times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord, and that he may send the Christ appointed for you, Jesus, whom heaven must receive until the time for restoring all the things about which God spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets long ago." Verse 22 and 23.
"For Moses said, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You must listen to everything he tells you. Anyone who does not listen to him will be completely cut off from among his people."
Okay. And again, all of that linking back to Deuteronomy 18. The next one is John 5. Did people just say this about Jesus, or did Jesus say it? Verses 45 and 46.
"But do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me."
Yeah. And it's an interesting tag on here. "But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" So that cuts to the heart. You don't even believe Moses. There's one more stop here, and that is John chapter 4. Was it only the Jews? Or, well, in John chapter 4, what about the Samaritans? Verse 25 of John 4.
"And the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things."
Okay. So the Samaritans also went back to that verse and put their hopes in the coming Messiah.
And the next verse, Jesus says, "I am."
Yeah.
"The one."
Okay. So we go back to Deuteronomy. All the way back to Deuteronomy and jump into chapter 19. Laws concerning the cities of refuge and other things. So we begin. "When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses," verse 2.
"You shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you to possess."
Okay. And this would be three cities on the western side of the Jordan. Moses had already set apart three cities on the eastern side. But on the western side, you need three cities, one in the north, one in the midsection, one in the south, so that they will be accessible. Verse 3, "You shall measure the distances and divide into three parts the area of the land that the Lord your God gives you as a possession, so that any manslayer can flee to them." Okay. verse 4.
This is the rule concerning the man who kills another and flees there to save his life. One who kills his neighbor unintentionally, without malice or aforethought.
As when someone goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood and his hand swings the axe to cut down a tree and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies, he may flee to one of these cities and live. That's a good clarifying example, isn't it? Verse 6.
Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage, overtake him if the distance is too great, and kill him, even though he is not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice aforethought.
Therefore, I command you, you shall set apart three cities. Verse 8.
The Lord your God enlarges your territory as he promised on oath to your forefathers and gives you the whole land he promised them.
Okay. If that happens, what would that mean? That would be from the Nile or from the bordered, from the Red Sea all the way to the Euphrates. What then? Well, here's a provision. Provided you are careful to keep all this commandment, which I command you today by loving the Lord your God and by walking ever in his ways. So if you do, if that happens, then you shall add three other cities to these three. So that would be nine in total, which never happened. Verse 10.
Lest innocent blood be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and thus guilt of bloodshed be upon you.
So if somebody doesn't kill his neighbor by accident and flees to the city, what then? Verse 11, but if anyone hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and attacks him and strikes him fatally so that he dies and flees into one of these cities, verse 12.
Then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die.
So this does not apply to a murderer, only to incidences of manslaughter by accident. 13, your eyes shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. And there's the big concern. The innocent blood that is shed defiles the land. It does something to the relationship between the people and God. Another concern, verse 14.
You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess.
Have you ever been involved in moving a landmark, an official landmark?
No.
Okay. Down south, where I was before this, the church was having some construction done, and that involved widening a sidewalk. And there was a landmark there. So they had to apply to move the landmark and to have very specific measurements of how far they were moving it. It involved writing letters and going up, 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 all the way to federal authorities.
Because, federal landmark?
Yeah, federal authorities govern landmarks. And it took quite a while to get this approved so that they could move it, I think it was 3 feet, and reset it 3 feet to the east of where it was. Very, very involved. Landmarks, since the time of the Bible, the early books of the Bible are seen as incredibly important, because if you're able to move a landmark, you can steal land. And all of a sudden, all the property descriptions are altered by the moving of the landmark. And that affects a lot of people.
Did they have to move or pay for that additional amount of land then?
You mean down south?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had to move the landmark for the widening of the sidewalk. The sidewalk had to be widened because the street was being widened and the sidewalk would be narrowed. And since the state was widening the street, they had to go through all this rigmarole. And it's just very fascinating to watch it happen. I don't know where the landmarks are around Morris, but there are landmarks, I will assure you. And they are registered with the city, with the state, all the way up. Especially in Israel, where the land that was defined by the boundaries was the inheritance given by God. It would be a violation against God. And then let's go on. What about witnesses? Verse 15, a single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. Okay, 16.
If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse a man of a crime,
then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. Okay, verse 18.
And the judges shall make careful inquiry, and indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother.
Oh, what are the consequences? Then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. That'd bring somebody up short if they wanted to falsely accuse a neighbor of, say a capital offense. Yeah. And the rest, verse 20.
And the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you.
And again, that will stop people from doing it.
It's one of the reasons why England doesn't have as many lawsuits, people suing over damages or whatever than we do, because if you falsely accuse, you have to pay all the bills.
You have to pay for the accused's lawyers.
Yep.
if you lose.
But here, you know, they can go ahead and sue somebody even if they know it's wrong, because there isn't any penalty.
It's harassment suits.
And there's enough of them.
And there's a whole lot of those going around. And people pay just to have it go away. But if it was proven false, then the accuser would have financial penalties.
But not here in America.
Okay.
As much. But there, yeah.
And verse 21, your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now, in the early church, if they applied this in the Roman days, when Athanasius was accused of murder, and they brought a severed hand to prove that he had murdered somebody and took the hand to use for sorcery. And the guy shows up who has supposedly been murdered.
Then they would have murdered the accusers.
Then what would happen to the accusers? This is not a bad idea. Okay. What about warfare? And Dalich notes this is not pertaining to warfare against the Canaanites. They were a special category because of the deep evil. But later on, when there was warfare against other nations than the Canaanites. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Verse 2.
And when
it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people.
And shall say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. Verse 4.
For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory.
Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And verse 6.
Has anyone planted a vineyard and not begun to enjoy it? Let him go home, or he may die in battle and someone else enjoy it.
And is there any man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. Verse 8.
And the officer shall speak further to the people and say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own.
So the first bunch of things that was said has to do with respecting the work and the building and this and that, and the idea that you are to enjoy the fruits of your labor, whether it is building a house and not moving in yet, planting a vineyard and not harvesting yet, becoming betrothed, promised to be married, and not yet being married. By the way, how long does it take a vineyard to grow?
7 years. I don't know.
And then once it grows, you are not allowed to eat of the fruit of the vineyard for 3 years. And then in the fourth year, the crop is dedicated. And then in the fifth year, you eat of it. So that's a good long time. Yeah, if war is impending on the horizon, somebody might choose to plant a vineyard. Mm-hmm. And then would be exempt from military service. But, you know, if that was his motivation, God would know that. And that vineyard would not be a blessing.
What is the crop dedicated to in that fourth year?
I forget. Let's see. Verse 6 of 20. Okay. And when a man had gone and actually married the wife, he was exempt for another year. Huh. Not only vineyards, but olive plantations as well. Fruit was not to be eaten for the first 3 years, and the fourth year was to be consecrated to the Lord. Only the fifth year and after.
So the priests get to eat.
Yeah. Okay. And then the faint of heart.
But Jesus didn't accept those excuses. Follow me, but I have to go and...
Well, this is making war.
Right.
With the possibility of dying.
Yeah.
Okay. Verse 9. And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. Verse 10. Laying siege.
When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it.
And if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. Verse 12.
But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it.
And when the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. Verse 14.
As for the women, the children, the livestock, and everything else in the city, you may take these as plunder for yourselves. And you may use the plunder the Lord your God gives you from your enemies.
Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. Verse 16.
However, in the cities of the nations of the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, do not leave alive anything that breathes.
Yeah, that's the Canaanites. But you shall devote them to complete destruction. And then detailing the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded. Verse 18.
Lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations, which they have done for their God, and you sin against the Lord your God.
And again, we come back to that. That is the danger that all of this is guarding against. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them, You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees they should be eaten by you?
Would you
actually purchase on Amazon? Verse 20.
Then
simply hang up and you avoid a little deal with our deal. Okay, verse 20. Only the trees that you know are not trees for food, you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls.
Okay. Part of the reason going back into the books of Moses before this, the trees that bore fruit were a gift from God to, well, first of all, Adam and Eve, and are to be recognized as gifts from God. So you didn't cut down fruit trees or fruit-bearing trees or olive trees or other trees. They just were to be recognized as a gift from God. And that finishes chapter 20.
So you finished two chapters so far.
So far. And okay. Verse 21.
Chapter 21.
Or chapter 21. If in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess, someone is found slain, lying in the open country, and it is not known who killed him, what then? There is a thing with blood guiltiness, even of an unknown murder that happened in the land. Verse 2.
Then your elders and your judges shall come out, and they shall measure the distance to the surrounding cities.
Say what? Distance to the surrounding cities.
Is it assuming that somebody from one of the surrounding cities came in?
No.
No.
That who has jurisdiction over the dispensation?
Yeah, basically, that's on target. And the elders of the city that is nearest to the slain man have a responsibility, because somebody has to have a responsibility. The elders of the city that is nearest to the slain man shall take a heifer that has never been worked and that has not pulled a yoke. Verse 4.
The elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley.
Okay. This is a substitutionary death because there is blood guiltiness. Then the priests, sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord, and by their word every dispute and every assault shall be settled. So they are God's representatives to go and declare that this has been done according to the provisions that are set up. Verse 6.
And all the elders of the town nearest the body shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley.
Washing your hands over the substitutionary victim that was there to carry the guilt was apparently a part of the culture for a long time. Does that bring to mind something that happened in the New Testament?
Pilate.
Yeah. Which marks Jesus as the substitutionary victim. Although Pilate does not know this. He thinks it's about him. And so do the elders of the town think it's about them. But it isn't. It's about the blood that has been shed and a substitutionary victim.
You would think the Pharisees would have picked that up right away.
If they recognized what the whole business of the sacrifices was all about, but it was easy for them to slip into, this is us doing things that declare us righteous. And the whole temple activity and sacrifice and everything else became about them rather than about God's provision for a substitutionary sacrifice centering in his son. But this is another inkling of what it really is all about. So verse 7, and they shall testify, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. Verse
8. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. An atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood.
Okay. Your version read, provide atonement. ESV says, accept atonement. And when you think about it, both are true, are they not?
Yes.
The atonement is provided for God, provided by God, and brought and accepted by God as the atonement is finally made in the one man. It also is, there's a little spin-off lesson for us to realize that, okay, if our hands did not do it, does that mean we are innocent and pure in the eyes of God? No. We are of the human race that does these things. And altogether bound up in sin. So what is the Hebrew word for provide atonement? What verse are we at? Okay, verse 8. No, merciful. Kaper. Kafir, which means the atonement cover, the mercy seat, turned into a verb. Okay. Did we read verse 9 yet?
No.
So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Verse 10. See, the law pertains to things that are disturbing. And it has to go there because the human race is
disturbing.
Yeah. Verse 10.
When you go out to war against your enemies and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, you take them captive.
Yeah. Killing all the men, by the way. And you see among the captives a beautiful woman and you desire to take her to be your wife. Okay, how do you treat her? Verse 12.
Whoa.
Yeah. And you shall bring her home to your house and she shall shave her head and trim her nails.
Which, by the way, was... Yeah, Dalich has something on this. Huh?
Purification.
Yeah. Customary signs of purification, symbols of her passing out of the state of a slave and of her reception into the fellowship of the covenant nation. Okay. That's the putting away of everything from before. And she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go in to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. Okay. And verse 14 is interesting.
If you're not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her.
Okay. So she is, by your taking her as a wife, she becomes part of the people. And if you change your mind and your heart, is she still a part of the people with rights?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Verse 15, if a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved,
Leah.
Well, then what then? Mm-hmm. Verse 16.
When he wills his property to his sons, he must not give the rights of the firstborn to the son of the wife he loves in preference to his actual firstborn, the son of the wife he does not love.
Okay.
So the firstborn is the firstborn.
Yeah.
Whichever wife it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Judah. Who was Judah born of?
Leah.
Not Rachel. Through whom is Jesus' ancestry traced?
Leah.
But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the first fruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Okay, that was not as disturbing as the next one. Verse 18.
A man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father, or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them.
Okay, so wild, unruly, and dangerous.
Then
there are consequences, but the consequences are taken out of the hands of the parents at some point here. Verse 19. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. Verse 20.
And they shall say to the elders of the city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey your voice, our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard.
Whoa. So this has to have rational reasons.
Whoa.
And Delitzsch notes, there are no witnesses called in this case because if a father and mother are to that point where they're willing to prefer the death penalty for their child, that has gotten extreme. And of course, in all rationality, the judges, if the father is a drunkard and not the son, then they could contradict because it's taken out of the hands of the parents. And assume in between verses 20 and 21 that it actually is true, which if the son is this way, well, all the neighbors know. Verse 21, then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. The law is disturbing because the human race is disturbing. Verse 22.
If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree.
Okay. His body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. Cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. Shall we chase that one just a little bit? Galatians 3, verse 13. Yep. Galatians 3, verse 13. Hey, anybody?
Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree.
Okay. And the verse reference from there goes directly back to Deuteronomy 21. And verse 14, so that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. Okay. Time and again, Jesus becoming the substitutionary victim, Jesus becoming cursed for us, or in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, God made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that in him we might be made the righteousness of God. Again and again, it is the same pattern. And it works its way into even the little tiny regulations of the Old Testament. And that's all.